I think this is the strongest argument that there is a God, because there's no theological point or connection that you're trying to prove in the syllogism itself, right?
To rephrase that for me, so, because
well, what you're doing is sometimes when people make an appeal to theology, they say, "Well, there is a God because there is a God." You say, "Well, there's all the, you know, religiously we should believe in a God." You're making kind of a spiritual appeal. Now, I believe in those very strongly, but if the question isn't about whether we're people of faith, the question is it rational?
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Salty Pastor Podcast. This podcast is designed to coach you up in your faith. The more you know, the more you can grow. Our goal is to not tell you what to think, but to help you think for yourself, because this is how your faith grows. When you know what you believe and why you believe it, you become a stronger person. My name is Jesse Mayer. I'll be your host, but we cannot do this without the one, the only, the Salty Pastor himself, Dr. Douglas Peake.
Hey, everybody. Welcome. I'm so glad that you're here. And once again, help us grow the Salty Pastor Podcast to reach more people by liking and subscribing. Go over to YouTube, look up the Salty Pastor Podcast channel, and then like and subscribe. That's been growing slowly, and we need you to jump over there. Help us out. Pretty soon, the Salty Pastor website will be up and running, and we've got a lot of new great stuff on there for you. Very excited about that. So we believe that that's important to really grow the ministry. There's a lot of things that we've been focusing on and doing that have been having a tremendous impact on people. And so I read, I don't know if I read this on Salty Pastor, but a person sent me a email this last week that just basically said, "Hey, someone told me about the Weeds in Our Garden series." And so I listened to all the Salty Pastors, and I just want you to know that's really brought me back to God. And so that's really a powerful statement, a powerful testimony. So the podcasting is having a difference in people's lives, and we want to keep that going, and I would love for you who listen to be a part of that.
Absolutely. We are currently in our series titled The Five Proofs of God, and it's all about the logical proofs that there is a God. Mm-hmm. The response was not quite what I expected. But
what did you expect?
I mean, I don't know. I think there's, in some ways, people are really excited, and in some ways, I think they're kind of settling into this. It's a really high logical, you're pushing some brain power a little bit more than I think people are used to in their daily lives, Pastor. So.
Well, we are pushing people a little bit, but that's what it means to grow. I said, you know, the point of this series is to grow your mental muscle.
Yes.
Right? You know, a little stronger in your mental muscles. So, you know, my biggest fear is that I'm not clear. Really want to be clear about it, because, you know, it's not whenever you go to a gym and they say, "Hey, you're going to do this exercise with these weights," they also then tell you it's very important to use the correct form. Because if you don't use the correct form, you can hurt yourself or it doesn't have any effect. And so, in a way, the whole correct form of stretching your mental muscle is all about clarity. So I know exactly where I'm pushing. One of the most important questions that we ever ask ourselves is whether or not there is a God. Now, that's pretty clear. What is sad to me, though, is that people don't think there are any rational proofs that there is a God. You know, we ask this question. It's one of the most important questions we ask. Well, then shouldn't we share the evidence rationally that exists that proves there is a God, in order for you to have all the knowledge to make an informed decision? Today we have this progressive ideology. It falls under different hats. It's called atheism, scientific materialism, secularism, humanism. A lot of these things, sometimes they call themselves naturalists. All of these things have one thing in common, and what they've done is they've gone to really great lengths to try and convince people that faith and reason are opposites, that they don't exist, right? So they draw what I call a false contrast. You know, they're trying to say, well, if you have faith, that's believing in irrational things. If you want to have faith, go ahead. You go, okay, well, first of all, I don't really accept your premise or your definition of faith, because this is completely absurd. Faith is actually the extension of reason. It is what allows reason to flourish and discover new things. Because just think of the logic of this. If reason is only about what exists, then all it would do is extend to understanding what exists. There would be no postulates concerning what could possibly be.
Mm.
And that, of course, you have to say, well, it takes faith to believe that reason can figure out what it's possible to be. And that's exactly right, which is the whole point of science. The scientific revolution came about because of faith, not in spite of faith. The Renaissance, the birth in new expressions of beauty and literature and music came about because of faith, not in spite of faith. How can an irrational movement of faith inspire the scientific revolution? It can't unless it's completely rational. The advances in medicine and healthcare, gosh, that was all because of faith, not in spite of it. So everything that we seem to enjoy and appreciate about our world today is a result of faith and reason being combined together, that they are part of the same thing. And this is why the rational proofs that God exists are so important to know and understand. Our faith is not irrational, but it is the best explanation, the best reasonable explanation of all the rational clues that exist in the universe today.
Yeah, I think what's amazing is we really are getting pushed, and these proofs are going to help us start fighting through some of the arguments that I think are really easy if you don't know them to go, well, yeah, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that makes, and when you hear them, you go, that does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. And so yeah. It's like, it's not that we're saying, well, everybody's dumb and they just need to like learn. It's, well, the problem is people are starting to come up with what seem like good arguments that are hard to refute unless you know how to refute them. Right.
Yeah.
And
mm-hmm.
So I think last week, starting with this first proof of the moral argument or the moral proof, was super good. And I think that, you know, walking through that, do you want me to
yes, walk
through
it? Do you remember what it is?
So the first one was, without God, there are no objective morals or duties,
mm-hmm.
right?
That's correct.
Premise number two, there are objective morals and duties, and we walked through why that mm-hmm. is true. And so, therefore, there is a God. Did I get the thing right? I didn't even, you did write them out for me. I'll be honest with the audience. It was on the outline, but I did do it without looking. So,
just a little coaching there.
I gotta test myself too. I'm not above testing myself.
Yeah,
so,
you know, and so I was talking to one of our staff that works with students and stuff, and I was asking her about, well, what do you think? She goes, well, you know, don't forget, you've got, some people have no idea what a moral is, and people don't know what objectivity or subjectivity are. So, you know, define your terms like, oh, that's always awesome. And that is, you know, a moral, it meaning something that's right or wrong. When you say, okay, it's wrong to kill somebody, or, you know, that's innocent. Okay, that we would all agree, okay, that's wrong. It's wrong to go and steal another person's car. Right. Those are called morals. Right. And then what happens is we'll do our morals come from objective or subjective sources. Now, if they come from subjective sources, that means human beings make them up, and human beings are really bad at making up morals, you know. And so I think that's really important. So what the premise, both of these premises basically argue is something that everybody knows to be true, that objective morals can only come from a source outside of human beings, okay? So that means there's a God or something. Number two, they exist. There are some things that are always wrong no matter what. No matter how much people try to rationalize or justify, in the end, there is an objective moral that we all live by, and that proves there is a God. So that's kind of how the proofs work. So it's the more you think about this proof, the more you lift it in your brain, so to speak, focus on it, then the stronger it becomes in your mind. It starts to make more and more sense, and you start to realize the implications of it. And that's really where the workout pays off in your life.
Absolutely. I think that we have to just keep those things in mind. Mm-hmm. So talk to me. We've covered proof number one. I want to talk about the next proof. I'm ready. Like, okay. I've been doing my, what did you say, going to the mental gym. I've been stretching. I've been doing some stretches this morning so that I'm ready to lift the next dumbbell that you're going to heap on, the next bench press I got to rep out.
All right. Well, we're going to load it up with a few plates here. And this one's a little heavier. It's called the cosmological argument. It's also known as Kalam's cosmological argument. And the reason it's called Kalam is because that's a reference to a Muslim scholastic tradition that doesn't exist anymore in Islam, but it did very early on. And what's interesting is today it's also known as the first cause or causation argument. This argument has more history than any other proof for God. And so it's one of my favorites. I also believe it's the strongest one. And the reason why is because the implications are just so significant. We'll jump into those early on. But it actually began with Aristotle. So this is why this is so powerful, is because the scholastic tradition that surrounds it is extensive, thousands of years. And Aristotle and everybody, you know, believers and non-believers alike today, agree that Aristotle's observation that we live in a causal universe is factually correct. We live in a cause-effect universe. The Thomas Aquinas came along, and Thomas Aquinas was really interesting. He was a Dominican friar. He was Roman Catholic, and he was a priest. And more of a monk, I guess, not really a priest. He was just a giant of the faith in his thinking. And he came up, he wrote what is called the Summa Theological. It's five massive books about theology. And one of the things he attempted to do in his Summa Theologica is he wanted to combine Aristotle's perspective of the world, right, the Aristotelian metaphysics, with the theology of God. Because Aristotle existed before the birth of Christ, right, 300 and something years. Three centuries before Christ was born. So he wanted to bring them together. Now, I'm speaking in very general terms here. And what he did is he pointed out, and he lived in the 1200s, that you could prove God, and he expanded this first cause argument of Aristotle, and he pushed it. Then scientists discovered the background redshift radiation that the universe in the universe, and therefore that proved the universe actually had a beginning. It wasn't infinite. Because so up until the mid-1900s, most scientists, even Einstein himself, believed that the universe was infinite, okay, and that it cycled back and forth. Well, they came to realize, and now it's commonly accepted as fact, that the universe had a beginning. It's commonly known as the Big Bang, and this because the strongest evidence or rational proof that there is a God, because it works like this. Everything that began.
Is this the next proof? Is that,
into? Okay. Let me articulate it this way. The fact that scientists discovered the Big Bang made this argument, this second proof, very powerful. And this is why I believe it's most powerful. And here's how it goes. Number one, everything that began to exist has a cause.
Okay.
Okay, so is that true? Everything that began to exist has a cause. In other words, something caused it to come into existence. So there's nothing out there. And Aristotle had all these different levels of existence, right?
Right.
Or things. So it could be a thought. It could be an action. It could be a plant. It could be a life. It could be a rock. It could be anything. So a planet, a solar system, it came into existence, but it had to have a cause that caused it to exist. So that's the first premise. So a lot of people today are trying to refute that premise, and we'll talk about that more later, but that's why you hear about the multiverse all the time, right?
Because people love that.
People love not the just, multiverse.
Not just the Marvel people, but it's been a thing.
Yeah, and it's kind of a way to get around the notion that our universe came into existence, that it has a beginning. So they're trying to argue that it's infinite,
right?
In a really strange, weird way that doesn't work mathematically. But hey, it's a great way to try to say there's no God, where you just make junk up. It's kind of the way. Now, the second premise goes like this. The universe began to exist. Now, this is a statement that's 100% scientifically able to test. You can prove it to be true or you can prove it to be false. There's no scientist who's intellectually
sound,
honest, who would say that the universe is infinite. Even those who try to use the multiverse, and string theory, all this kind of stuff, to try to prove that universes are infinite, okay? They would say, no, our universe is finite. It came into existence because the scientific evidence for it is overwhelming. And it goes, the scientific evidence says over and over again that the universe is expanding only in one direction. The scientific evidence says that the universe is cooling too. This is very important. It's losing energy.
Right.
And these are the laws of thermodynamics at play.
Right. I was going to say what you're saying so far is like a cause. Every reaction has an, you know,
right,
action.
Equal
every,
and opposite.
Every action has an equal and opposite.
Reaction,
so, which
yes.
plays into the same idea of like things
cause
have a cause and effect, right? And so scientifically we see that. Science is showing that, yes. I mean, there's some people out there that are speculating, you know, we're all just living in, you know, ether and it's not real
this
and the
crazy,
we're
yeah.
the Matrix or whatever. But yeah. sure, let's just say that the universe exists for the people that actually are doing the science yeah. and can show that, yes.
Yeah, so, you know, the second premise is almost impossible to refute, right? Because it's 100% scientifically firm. There's no theological or philosophical proof. It's just a simple statement of fact. The universe began to exist. So nobody can really refute that. So the first one is everything that began to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Now, this is what makes this argument so powerful because it's very understated, right? It's not trying to make this massive logical leap. All it says is that the universe that you live in had a cause. Now, why is that significant? Well, let's watch a video because I want the video. They just say it so much more quickly. If you're listening, listen to the video. You'll miss some of the graphics, but that's okay. It all makes sense. Let's play the video.
Does God exist? Or is the material universe all that is, or ever was, or ever will be? One approach to answering this question is the cosmological argument. It goes like this. Whatever begins to exist has a cause. The universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause. Is the first premise true? Let's consider. Believing that something can pop into existence without a cause is more of a stretch than believing in magic. At least with magic, you've got a hat and a magician. And if something can come into being from nothing, then why don't we see this happening all the time? No, everyday experience and scientific evidence confirm our first premise. If something begins to exist, it must have a cause. But what about our second premise? Did the universe begin? Or has it always existed? Atheists have typically said that the universe has been here forever. The universe is just there, and that's all. First, let's consider the second law of thermodynamics. It tells us the universe is slowly running out of usable energy, and that's the point. If the universe had been here forever, it would have run out of usable energy by now. The second law points us to a universe that has a definite beginning. This is further confirmed by a series of remarkable scientific discoveries. In 1915, Albert Einstein presented his general theory of relativity. This allowed us, for the first time, to talk meaningfully about the past history of the universe. Next, Alexander Friedman and Georges Lemaître, each working with Einstein's equations, predicted that the universe is expanding. Then in 1929, Edwin Hubble measured the red shift in light from distant galaxies. This empirical evidence confirmed not only that the universe is expanding, but that it sprang into being from a single point in the finite past. It was a monumental discovery, almost beyond comprehension. However, not everyone is fond of a finite universe, so it wasn't long before alternative models popped into existence. But one by one, these models failed to stand the test of time. More recently, three leading cosmologists, Arvind Bord, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, prove that any universe which has on average been expanding throughout its history cannot be eternal in the past, but must have an absolute beginning. This even applies to the multiverse, if there is such a thing. This means that scientists can no longer hide behind a past eternal universe. There is no escape. They have to face the problem of a cosmic beginning. Any adequate model must have a beginning, just like the standard model. It's quite plausible then that both premises of the argument are true. This means that the conclusion is also true. The universe has a cause. And since the universe can't cause itself, its cause must be beyond the space-time universe. It must be spaceless, timeless, immaterial, uncaused, and unimaginably powerful. Much like God. The cosmological argument shows that, in fact, it is quite reasonable to believe that God does exist.
What do you think?
Well, I think they explain it well. It helps you start understanding kind of where you're heading with this, Pastor, and I think that's super important. Because I think it can be a little out there and abstract, which I think, again, like I said, I did my stretches. I'm ready to work my brain. But as you start working through it, you're like, well, yeah, like we see this in thermodynamics. We see this in so many proofs in our science that, yes, there has to be something for something to happen. And so when we start trying to define, well, how would this have occurred without that something, then you're like, well, but all the words you're using are things that kind of describe God, right? Like, I think that video summarizes it very well. So what are, so that kind of brings me to this, like, okay, I get it. This seems like pretty like solid proof. Obviously there's going to be people that disagree and want to prove this wrong. So are there arguments against the cosmological proof?
Well, there might be, but I think this is the strongest argument that there is a God, because there's no theological point or connection that you're trying to prove in the syllogism itself, right?
To rephrase that for me, so, because
well, what you're doing is sometimes when people make an appeal to theology, they say, well, there is a God because there is a God. You say, well, there's all the, you know, religiously we should believe in a God. You're making kind of a spiritual appeal. Now, I believe in those very strongly. But if the question isn't about whether we're people of faith, the question is it rational?
And I think that's what's cool about this series is, theoretically, like, you don't have to be a believer to go through this series.
Correct.
To understand the rationality of, hey, rationally, this makes the most sense.
And so that's why it's so powerful. But what it does is, once you agree to it, it forces you to deal with the first cause, the uncaused cause. It's like, okay, there has to be a cause for the universe.
Right.
Okay, well, as soon as you admit that to yourself, that that's rational and logically consistent, then you have to say, okay, well, what kind of cause? And this is where people really have to push themselves. And this is where a lot of people who started out to disprove God end up saying, well, I had to prove God because it was, I have to believe in God. It's the only rational option. See, it has to do with the first cause. Because if both premises are true and cannot be refuted, the conclusion is always necessary, right? That's one of the laws of logic and rhetoric. So you start thinking about the nature of something that has to exist in order to create the universe. And like it said in the video, well, it has to be outside of space, time, and matter, right? And what you start to do is you start to realize, oh, okay, well, what are we describing then in the book of Revelation? There's a quote. It says, "It is done. I am the Alpha and Omega, the beginning and the end. I give water to the one who thirsts from the spring of the water of life without cost." Right? In Revelation 22:13, it says, Jesus says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end." So you start to realize that it not only has to be outside of space, time, and matter, it has to be infinite. Right? There's no beginning or end. I am the Alpha. I am the Omega. I was before. Before there was, I am. In Exodus chapter 3, I think what's so interesting is that when we became materialistic in our orientation, basically modernity, what we did is we started to read the Bible differently than the way the authors intended it to be read. And so, for instance, when Moses goes up onto the mountain and he sees the burning bush, it's God revealing himself. He says, "Well, you're going to go and set my people." He goes, "Well, what am I supposed to tell them who sent me? Who are you?
Who are you?
What's your name?" Right? And this is what's interesting is God says, "I am who I am." And so that's translated in the Hebrew as Yahweh, which the Jewish people never say that word.
Right.
Okay, because you're not allowed to say the name of God, but it actually comes from the Hebrew verb haya, which means to be. And so basically Moses says, "Well, who do I say sent me?" And the answer is, "I exist. I am."
Mm.
And so the point of this thing is that God transcends all the categories of time, space, and matter. So he's pre-existent to all of this. So what happens is a lot of people who try to refute this use a very unintellectual approach. And they say, "Well, then who created God?" They think that they're so, you know, smarmy smart. And they're not. Because now what they are is, okay, now you're basically caught, right, and called a regressive infinity loop. Okay. In other words, well, who created God? Well, then, you know, the turtle created God. Well, what created the turtle? Well, this did. And so in infinity, it's called a regressive infinity loop. It's illogical. It's paradoxical. The people who have refuted the whole notion of infinity regression is the same people who've refuted actual infinity. Actual infinity does not exist. A lot of people don't understand this because it's a paradox. It doesn't exist. But it's a necessary idea that's assumed in order to do mathematics. But there's no proof in mathematics that it exists. You just assume that it is a probability or possibility. So that's what's so strange about this is that when you start thinking about the first cause, it has to be outside of space, time, and matter. It has to be infinite. It has to be omnipotent. It has to have all the power, because just think of the power it would take to create a universe. And we're told how big the universe is. You know, it's made up of billions and billions and billions of galaxies, and then solar systems make up galaxies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the universe is filled with the Milky Way. You know, these are galaxies that make up the Milky Way, and inside the galaxy, one galaxy in particular, is our solar system.
Right.
Right? And when they say, "Well, where does that exist?" they show the Milky Way. It's kind of this spiral thing. And then out, way out on this little arm is the galaxy in which we exist, right? And then inside of that is our solar system. It's just so incredibly massive. Think of the power. It has to be absolutely omnipotent, have all the power. It has to be omniscient. It has to know all things. To create space, time, and matter in a cause and effect, it has to know everything. In 1 John 3:20, the Bible says, "Don't worry if your heart condemns you, because God is greater than your heart. He knows everything." Right? And you start to realize, wow, that's a lot.
That is a lot.
The first cause has to be personal. This is what's really so interesting. This is where you really get, is that the cause that created the universe has to be personal in nature. Okay? In Colossians, Paul says the following. The Son, Jesus, is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for in him all things were created. Notice how he says, in him things were created. Things in heaven and on earth, visible, invisible, whether thrones or powers, rulers or authorities, all things have been created through him and for him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together. He is the head of the body of the church. He's the beginning and the firstborn from among the dead, so that in everything he might have supremacy. For God was pleased to have all his fullness dwell in him, and through him to reconcile to himself all things, whether things on earth or things in heaven, by making peace through his blood, the cross. In essence, it is God, the one described in the Bible, that best is unified with this notion of first cause.
So I think that basically, I mean, all of those aspects basically point to,
yeah,
there being a God, right? Yes. Like
cause is God.
Yes, it's pretty hard to deny that.
That's why I love this proof. It pushes you to ask those questions and draw those conclusions.
Yeah, and I think that's so important because this is something that, you know, with some studying and really diving into this, this makes it really hard to refute.
Yes.
Are there any criticisms against this argument? You said there weren't any good ones, but yeah. I mean,
well,
are there
as you
anything?
Can see, scientific evidence shows that there isn't really any way to debunk the argument scientifically unless you start creating multiverses. And, you know, I mean, media loves this. You remember the show Men in Black? All those shows,
yeah.
And at the end, they always show a universe within another universe within another universe. And that's the whole point of multiverses is that, oh, well, space and time is created in an infinite, you know, other universe that was created in another. But now you're back to the regressive infinity problem, and it's a paradox. And you go, okay, that just doesn't work. Famous atheists today, by the name of Dennett and even Stephen Hawking in his last book, they just try to argue that the universe created itself, okay? But, of course, this is completely irrational. It's not that there's no scientific or mathematical evidence. It's completely irrational that something of this magnitude pre-existed in order to create itself. There's just no logic to that. It's completely a religious affirmation if you try to believe that. There's no rational reason to believe it. So it defies the very laws of physics that they depend on to understand the universe. So these are the basic scientific facts about the universe that all physicists believe. The universe had a beginning. The universe is only expanding, meaning going in one direction, and the universe is cooling, and therefore it's running out of energy. That's it. So there's no real good way to debunk it unless you become a religious fanatic.
I think that is where some of the world has gone, if we're
yes.
being really honest. Well, thank you so much for sharing all this with us. I'm hoping that on Thursday we're going to have more time to talk about this mm-hmm. and how it impacts and how we're seeing that play out with people and arguments in the world these
yeah.
days.
Yeah.
But I really appreciate that, Pastor. I think this is, like I said, I'm really excited about this series. I think it's going to push us quite a bit, but I think it's pushing us in a good way because we do need to grow. We do need to know what we believe and why we believe it. And this is one of the best ways to figure out what do you really believe.
And even if you don't remember all the details and all the thing, I do want anybody and everybody to walk away from this realizing that my faith is rational. It is reasonable to believe what I believe. This isn't some mytho pipe dream that people just thought up and it's crazy tunes. It's not. It's extremely rational.
Well, thank you so much. I'm excited to talk more about this on Thursday, and thank you guys for joining us today, and we'll see you later here on the Salty Pastor Podcast.
Keep thinking for yourself.